Hey everybody, Eric Trexler here with Mass Office Hours, and tonight is a very special episode of Mass Office Hours because I am joined by the newest doctor in evidence-based fitness, Lauren Colenso-Semple. Dr. Lauren Colenso-Semple, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. That sounds good. I like the sound of it.
Well, first of all, congratulations. Obviously, completing your PhD is a massive achievement. The Mass crew is now fully PhD'd, all four across the board. Do you want to tell the folks who maybe haven't been following along what your PhD was about?
Sure. The primary focus was the influence of ovarian hormones on the skeletal muscle adaptations to exercise. So one arm of that was looking at the influence of menstrual cycle phase on muscle protein synthesis in response to exercise. And the other arm of that was looking at oral contraceptive pill phase also in response to exercise. And this is a really important question for the scientific community in that female participants are often excluded, or researchers are reluctant to include female participants because of the potential influence of the ovarian hormone profile on, you know, various performance measures and other relevant outcomes, you know, exercise-induced adaptations, etc. So if we don't have to worry about things like whether somebody is on birth control or not, or what phase of the menstrual cycle they're in for testing purposes, et cetera, then we can be a lot more inclusive, you know, from a research perspective and really ramp up the research in female participants. And it's also really relevant, you know, from a fitness perspective, because there's a real fad right now with sort of menstrual cycle phase-based training and people marketing these programs and saying, well, for this half of your cycle, you should be doing this type of exercise. And then for the latter half, you should be doing another type of exercise. And it's pretty confusing to be in that landscape right now, especially as a newer lifter or, you know, fitness enthusiast who's really trying to do things properly, but not really sure whether you need to worry about that or not. So essentially, the results of my studies concluded that contraceptive pill phase and oral and menstrual cycle phase did not influence the muscle protein synthesis in response to exercise. And so this is a really important step, not only in the literature, but I think also in the greater fitness community.
Awesome. Now, I am curious, did you measure any biomarkers related to inflammation?
Did not, no.
Okay. I'm just curious because there's a little bit of literature trickling out. I covered it in Mass several months ago as well, looking at CRP levels, particularly when it comes to oral contraceptives, more so than throughout the menstrual cycle. But I was just curious for selfish purposes because that's an area of the literature I've been keeping my eye on. But no, I mean, that's fantastic. It's like you said, there's of course the practical application out in the real world of trying to decide, you know, do I have to train female athletes differently than male athletes, you know, across the board? And then within my sample of female athletes, do I have to, you know, keep a kind of complicated calendar going to make sure everybody's kind of on the right training cycle for their phase? Certainly simplifies things a lot, both on the research side and on the practical application side to see the type of findings that you're reporting. So great work. And once again, congratulations.
Thank you so much. And I'll just add that, you know, one of my biggest takeaways from working with both of these subgroups is just the high variability. I utilized a within subject design, meaning for the menstrual cycle phase participants, I tested each in one phase and then the other. So it was a crossover trial. And then same for the contraceptive users. It was during the phase in which they're taking the active hormones and then the sort of placebo or inactive pill week. And the reason that was really important is because when you actually measure all the blood hormones and you look at even the variability in the protein synthesis response itself, there's so much nuance there. So again, bringing it to a kind of practical application setting, you realize that clearly a one-size-fits-all program is inappropriate because cycle length is highly variable, phase length, ovulation timing, and certainly the magnitude of the hormone fluctuations, and therefore the hormone profile during which you do this testing is highly, highly variable.
Yeah, good point. All right, so good stuff. I'm sure we'll be hearing a lot more about some of the practical applications of different types of contraceptive methods and other things that impact ovarian hormones in the months that follow within the pages of the Mass Research Review. That is certainly one of your many areas of expertise. Now, unsurprisingly, the live chat right now is just littered with people congratulating Dr. Colenso Semple. A hashtag here, simply the best. I think that kind of wins for tonight. We also had Trexelsior in there, which is, of course, good. Large sample size, a little research pun. Trextopia, you got to throw that in there anyway. So love the hashtags. And folks, drop a hashtag in there, or not a hashtag, drop a comment in there. Let us know where you're listening from. We've been getting quite a fascinating spread of international participation over the last several episodes. So let us know where you're viewing from. And even if it's not an exotic, faraway place for someone who is centered in North Carolina, we get someone usually every week from Wisconsin, and that's just as cool as any other place on the planet. I like cheese. I like beer. You can't go wrong with it. All right. So before we get into the real hard science stuff, we've got our housekeeping. We got some notes to go through here. Let me pull them up here. We have a huge, huge, huge sale going on right now for the Mass Research Review. Of course, the Mass Research Review is what makes these office hours possible. That is our monthly research review. Comes out the first of the month every month. We did have an issue come out today, May 1st. Well, truth be told, we usually get it out a day early, but we never get it out late. So new issue is out here, and it's a really good one. So I'm going to talk about some of the studies or the articles in it in a few minutes here, but definitely be sure to check out this new issue that just got published if you're a subscriber. And if you're not a subscriber, maybe think about becoming one. So this is our biggest sale of the year. It's our anniversary sale, 7th anniversary. Quite a long journey we've been on here at the Mass Research Review. The sale, all of our subscriptions are 30% off. It's the lowest prices that you're going to see. And the sale ends on Friday. So make sure you take advantage of that before the sale ends. Also, a new thing in the Mass Research Review, if you're currently a subscriber or if you're about to become one, Mike Zordos has a live video on Monday. That's going to be exclusively just for subscribers. You're gonna find that video within the subscriber website. So that's not going to be on YouTube. Now, if you miss it, that's okay. You don't have to catch it live. You will be able to replay it on the member site. But again, that one's going to be just for current subscribers. That'll be live May 6th at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. And the video is going to be about positives and negatives of common prescription strategies. So all about common strategies when it comes to prescribing training. A couple other things. Of course, if you want to support the show, if you like it, that'd be a nice thing to do. First thing you could do right now, if you're in the live chat, is like the video. That really helps. Whenever you happen to listen or watch this episode, make sure you like, rate, subscribe, review wherever you get it. Tell a friend, share a link with a friend. And the best way to help us out, one of the many ways, is to join us live. You can pop right into the live chat, ask us questions, push back, respond, argue with us, get agitated, whatever you like to do. So joining us live Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern is a great way to participate. Of course, if you can't make it, we understand. If you want to submit a question when we're not live, you can go to massresearchreview.com/officehours to submit a question anytime. Lauren, how'd I do? That was a lot of notes.
I think you covered everything.
Perfect.
Excellent job. Well done.
All right. And folks, I'm serious. The sale is going to end on Friday. You don't want to miss it. Okay. 30% off. If you're watching live in the chat right now, go ahead and hit pause. Go subscribe. Come back. We'll be here for you. All right. Let's get into the science more. That's what we're here for. We're science people. To introduce the episode today, we often, in recent weeks, we've been doing kind of an introductory segment. And today, I want to talk about interpreting science. And more specifically, I want to talk about the hierarchy of evidence for two reasons. First of all, the hierarchy of evidence is important. And second of all, the hierarchy of evidence is sometimes a little bit misunderstood or maybe misapplied. Now, the reason I want to talk about this to start the show is because it comes up, I would say, twice, maybe even three times in the newest issue of the Mass Research Review. So, for example, this month I reviewed a study about time-restricted eating, which on the internet is often called intermittent fasting. So there's these three terms you're going to see: time-restricted eating, time-restricted feeding, intermittent fasting. In the fitness world, they're all used pretty interchangeably, and it basically means there's going to be a fixed window during the day where you consume all your calories. It's going to be, you know, maybe in the ballpark of 4 to 8 hours long, and then you're going to fast for the other, you know, 16 to 20 hours that day. So it's about compressing all of your energy intake for the day into a relatively shorter time window. Now, we've written about time-restricted eating many times in the Mass Research Review, and generally speaking, we typically conclude, based on the totality of the evidence, that it is something that has a neutral, maybe a slightly positive effect on cardiometabolic health parameters. It seems to be pretty helpful for some people when they're trying to diet down. A lot of folks notice that when they restrict their feeding window, their meals get bigger, they feel a lot fuller, and then when they're outside of their feeding window, they just kind of get busy with something else. They get distracted. They're not sitting around thinking about their next meal all day because they know that it's way off in the distance. So a lot of folks tend to note that time-restricted eating helps them focus less on food when they're dieting, and also helps with a little bit of fullness, helps reduce hunger a little bit. So when we talk about time-restricted eating, a lot of times we're talking about the perceived or purported benefits. But in my new article this month, I reviewed a new study, which is just an abstract. It hasn't been published as a full paper yet. It hasn't been thoroughly peer-reviewed the way papers get reviewed. But nonetheless, it made a lot of headlines. It was published as an abstract. It was a poster that was presented at a conference. And essentially what they found was that time-restricted eating was associated with increased risk of cardiac death. Now, Lauren, I don't know about you, but I enjoy my heart. I enjoy not being dead. Cardiac death is something I'd like to avoid as long as I can, to be completely honest. So a lot of folks who in the fitness world are really enthusiastic about time-restricted eating, they see this study and they go, oh, that doesn't sound great at all. Now, in my article, I take a really close look at this new analysis. This was an observational epidemiological analysis using NHANES data. And NHANES data, basically, it's this giant database that is managed and collected by the United States government. They've been doing it for many, many years. Every 2 years, they do a new cycle of NHANES data where they get questionnaire data, they get physical measurements, they get blood biomarkers. It's really a comprehensive battery of tests. So it's a tremendously valuable resource. But when you're analyzing that data, you are using it in a completely observational manner, right? You don't get to go in and tell the folks, hey, we're going to randomly, you know, assign you to these different groups and experimentally control this and control that. So in my article, I talked a little bit about why that might have impacted the findings of this study, specifically linking or associating or correlating time-restricted eating with cardiac death or the risk of cardiac death. The reason I put emphasis and use three different synonyms is because with this type of study design, we can't say time-restricted eating causes increased prevalence or incidence of cardiac death, right? All we can say is that there's an association or a correlation there. Now, in the article, I go into a lot of detail about kind of two main things that we should always think about with this type of study. First of all, it is possible that there is some confounding going on. So to put that in more tangible terms, it's possible that some variable that was not accounted for in the analysis may have been impacting a person's likelihood of, having shorter feeding windows. Because again, folks were not assigned to these feeding windows. It's just kind of what you typically happen to do, or at least happen to report on self-reported diet tools. So, the idea is like, there could be a number of factors that increase someone's or that impact somebody's feeding windows that may also have an impact on a variety of different health metrics and their likelihood of cardiovascular death, poorer cardiometabolic health. We can't necessarily say that one thing caused the other within this design, and it's possible that there is just some other variables kind of in this mixture that were causing a relationship or an apparent relationship that wasn't actually, causative in nature. So, maybe there is some kind of variable that is impacting, an individual's eating pattern, also having an impact on a variety of different risk factors and health outcomes. And we're just kind of seeing a kind of spurious relationship here, or at least a relationship that's not causative in nature. So, for example, a really easy one would be somebody, you can imagine a scenario where someone is working like crazy, right? Low socioeconomic status, they're working a couple jobs, they do not have time to really take care of themselves because they really need to work multiple shifts a day to make ends meet, right? Well, if we look at the epidemiological literature, low socioeconomic status tends to be correlated with poorer health outcomes. So that could be one thing where we're saying, okay, this is causing both a shorter feeding window because you're just going from shift to shift. You don't have really time to sit down and have several meals a day. And it's also associated with these negative health outcomes. Maybe that's what's going on. That's just an example. You could also imagine, someone in that situation, the reason that low SES is often associated with poor health outcomes is it's so hard to prioritize your health and create a really healthy food environment, make time for exercise, things like that. So you can see how there can be these confounding variables like socioeconomic status that are impacting both of these outcomes without an actual causal relationship between the two outcomes. Another thing I talk about in this article is the fact that it's kind of the other side of the coin. So with observational research like this, people will say, okay, we know that there's all these things that could be impacting these relationships, all these confounding variables. We're going to control for them in the model. But the problem is sometimes when you have a ton of covariates that are in this model that you're trying to adjust for or control for or account for, those are all kind of used synonymously, even though there's some distinctions between them. When you have all these different variables in the model, and they all kind of correlate with your predictor of interest, which in this case would be a person's kind of the timing of their eating pattern, you can end up with statistical models that folks would call very unstable. And so what happens is if you're controlling for all these variables that are correlated with your predictor, then whatever's left over after you've controlled for all those things becomes this kind of arbitrary, vague, hard to define, hard to replicate abstraction of a variable. And so the way that correlates with some outcome is really hard to predict from sample to sample to sample, because it's this really weird, hard to define kind of, there's a lot of chance involved with kind of what portion of that variance is left over for the model. So if I use some statistical jargon that was a bit out of reach there, I do apologize for that, but I'm not smart enough yet to describe things in super easy to digest ways when it comes to statistics. But the short version is it's possible that these results were impacted by confounders that were not accounted for. It's also possible that these findings were impacted by over-adjusting the model and creating, basically a very abstract, hard-to-define predictor that is, you know, perhaps not really representative of the true effect of an individual's eating pattern on these different health outcomes. So with any epidemiological study, you have this give and take where the more you control for, the more, especially if those covariates are highly correlated with your predictor, the more unstable your model can be. And the more challenging it is to replicate in the future. And then on the other side of the coin, if you say, well, I'm not going to adjust for anything, now you've got all these confounders. Now, that was a bit more stat heavy than I plan to get into, but it all comes down to this hierarchy of evidence concept. So when we look at randomized controlled trials, really high quality experimental studies on time restricted eating, when they do measure outcomes that are relevant to cardiometabolic health and theoretically risk factors for cardiovascular death, time-restricted eating seems to either have not much of an effect at all or actually a positive effect on these different biomarkers and risk factors for cardiovascular death. So when we have several studies that actually randomize people to a specific eating pattern, you know, really high-quality causative evidence showing that this eating pattern doesn't seem to have deleterious cardiovascular, cardiac death related outcomes, we have this whole body of literature building showing neutral or positive effects, and then this one observational study comes around. It's important to contextualize that and to understand that observational studies, because of some of those limitations I mentioned earlier, are considered a generally lower quality form of evidence. And we certainly shouldn't throw out a bunch of, you know, well-designed randomized controlled trials just because this new observational study came along and made a bunch of headlines. So that's the focus of one of my articles. The focus of another one is a eye-popping study on apple cider vinegar. Lauren, have you ever had apple cider vinegar?
I have.
What'd you think?
By itself, it's rough.
Yeah. So
some very
people,
vinegary.
Yeah, well, it's vinegar, and you know it. So some people take shots of it, like health enthusiasts. This has always kind of been in that, like, alternative medicine kind of fitness industry.
My roommates did that in college, the shots,
yeah.
Like, thinking it would make them skinnier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's not advised, by the way. For a few reasons. First of all, it tastes terrible, and a shot is kind of brutal. Second of all, it is highly, highly acidic, so it is really bad for the enamel of your teeth. So I would definitely not make a habit of taking regular shots of apple cider vinegar. But Lauren, I mean, what year was that when your roommates were using it?
10 years ago.
Okay, yeah, so this has been around, right? It's kind of always been floating in the, like, homeopathy, naturopath. How do you say that word?
Naturopath?
Naturopathic? Yeah, all that kind of stuff. It's late. I've been working very hard today. but yeah, it's always been around in these kind of, like, health-adjacent kind of areas, but it's never really been embraced by mainstream science or medicine. But there was a new study on apple cider vinegar, and the reason I say it was eye-popping was because they had four different groups. There was a placebo, 5 milliliters per day, 10 milliliters per day, and 15 milliliters per day. There were 30 people per group. So this was a randomized controlled trial with a pretty generous sample size, 120 people for a 12-week trial. You know, that's nothing to sneeze at. And what they found was that the folks in the 10 and the 15 milliliter per day groups, the results indicate that they lost 7.5 kilograms of weight over a 12-week period. For those who use American Freedom units, that's like 15 pounds, a little above 15 pounds in a matter of 12 weeks. Now, that is in a paper where the researchers report that participants were instructed to maintain their normal diet and exercise habits. And the researchers indicated that they collected diaries and checked them to ensure and to verify that participants were not dramatically changing their diet or exercise habits. So we've got this 7.5 kilogram weight loss that doesn't seem to be attributed in the paper to consuming fewer calories, nor does it seem to be attributed to exercising more. And that leaves the reader with some pretty big questions of what happened there? How does that work? Now, in my article, I go into depth about how surprising these findings are, how they compare to prior research. And frankly, I boil the conversation down to biological plausibility, which is important. It is exceedingly difficult to explain how these 7.5 kilograms were lost over a 12-week period. And if you look at other interventions that cause similar amounts of weight loss over 12 weeks, there's basically two that come to mind. One is Ozempic, and the other drugs similar to it. They often tend to cause about 7-ish kilograms of weight loss in the first 12 weeks of administration. And the reason that that is an interesting comparator is because Ozempic basically created a new industry. It is such an outlier in terms of being a wildly successful fat loss remedy or fat loss tool that it has, like I said, basically created an industry within an industry. And it is a massive shift, like a meteor, kind of like plowing into the pharmaceutical industry and therefore having trickle-down effects on the health insurance industry. I mean, we're talking about, you know, as I think I forget the exact stat that I could quote here, but I think folks were estimating that it was going to become a $100 billion industry within the next certain number of years. Here, I'll try to find the exact projection there. So the anti-obesity drug market is projected to swell to $100 billion by 2030. So to say that, you know, essentially free shot of vinegar. I mean, if you buy like a gallon of apple cider vinegar, the cost is like zero. I mean, if it could repeatedly, you know, if you could reproduce this finding in a reliable fashion and trust that giving any person off the street, 10, 15 milliliters a day of apple cider vinegar would have these types of effects on body weight regulation, you could save any health insurance company literally hundreds of millions of dollars within the United States. So we should not take lightly the idea that these results appear to be comparable to something like Ozempic, and that should really cause us to become, there's the old adage that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. This would certainly be one of those cases where you'd say, I'm going to need someone to help me understand the biological plausibility of that. The other intervention that has a similar effect size when it comes to weight loss is DNP. And DNP is a really weird little drug, which is no longer prescribed in the United States. It was banned in like the 1930s. Now, Lauren, the 1930s were crazy. If something is banned in the 1930s, it should be banned, right? Like, we were doing a lot of wacky stuff in medicine in the 1930s. If something was raising alarms back then that's kind of problematic to me. I'm getting a nod of agreement. That works. So anyway, DNP is an uncoupler. Basically, it makes the inner membrane of your mitochondria, the inner membrane that surrounds the matrix of the mitochondria, makes it leaky. And in my article, I kind of talk through the biochemistry and the energetics of why that matters. But the short version is when you take DNP, you churn through calories like crazy. Your metabolic rate skyrockets. Resting metabolic rate often goes up by 30 or 40%. And humans are inefficient, just like a car engine, when it comes to converting energy. So when we're burning a lot of energy, we generate a lot of body heat. And a lot of folks, when they were taking too much DNP back in the 20s and 30s, or when they were being exposed to it in industrial settings, they were dying of complications that in many cases were actually linked back to hyperthermia. So, you'll still see a couple articles every year, maybe one or two every year, about someone who bought DNP off the internet, took it to lose weight, and unfortunately died of complications from this dramatic impact on metabolic rate and some of the cardiovascular risk that goes along with that. So all of that is to say, DNP, when you're telling me that something theoretically might be, the reason I say this is the study basically indicated that folks were not changing their diet. So you might say, okay, well, then maybe this vinegar stuff was increasing energy expenditure. Well, when you look at it and you say, well, if we're going to assume that's the case, then this would have to be as effective at increasing energy expenditure as DNP, which was so effective at increasing energy expenditure that was banned in the 30s and has caused dozens of documented deaths within the peer-reviewed literature. I mean, it works so well that your body just starts cooking, basically. I mean, it is really wild stuff. So all that is to say, I'm highly skeptical of this new finding. Of course, not making any kind of allegation of impropriety or fraud or anything like that. But when I say I'm skeptical of it, what I mean is I'm very skeptical that we are going to see in future studies, if folks try to replicate this finding, I find it very difficult to believe that this idea of losing 7.5 kilograms in 12 weeks is going to end up being a robust, generalizable, and reproducible estimate of the effect of apple cider vinegar on weight loss. And when we look at other studies that have experimentally tested apple cider vinegar and looked at changes in body weight, the effects have been very, very, very modest. So, like I said, not making allegations, not really into that kind of thing, but definitely skeptical that the finding is going to kind of hold up over time or be reproduced and replicated in future research in this area. So this study is an outlier compared to the work that has been done previously, and I don't expect we're going to see a wave of new apple cider vinegar studies saying, oh yeah, this is definitely as effective as Ozempic or as effective as DMP, depending on which mechanism of action you think is kind of behind the scenes here. Now, the reason I bring this up in a discussion about the hierarchy of evidence is because when I posted about this on the internet, someone said, well, wait a minute, this is a randomized controlled trial. This is a high quality form of evidence. And they said, and we're talking about a sample of 120 people. So based on the hierarchy of evidence, you should take these results over everything else that we've seen about apple cider vinegar. And that is why I really like a paper. I forget the author and year, which is not ideal because I need to dig that up at some point. But they basically present the hierarchy of evidence as being like, instead of shaped like a pyramid, which is obviously trademarked by Eric Helms, he should be getting a kickback from that. Instead of shaping it like a pyramid, they shaped it like a wavy pyramid. And they basically use some imagery to kind of suggest like, yeah, this hierarchy generally leads us in the right direction, but you have to really carefully scrutinize every single study. And what that means is you have to look at it and evaluate the strengths and weaknesses, look for limitations, potentially look for errors, consider the biological plausibility of what you're reading, compare it to other studies on the topic. And at the end of the day, you have to be open to the fact that every now and then, you might find a terrible meta-analysis that is not more useful than a really good observational study, even though meta-analyses are much higher on the hierarchy of evidence than an observational study. So when we look at that study on time-restricted eating, you know, that's a great example of when the hierarchy of evidence kind of helps anchor us in terms of not overreacting to a new observational study because we've seen high quality randomized controlled trials in that area. When it comes to this apple cider vinegar study, the hierarchy of evidence is actually has a tendency to lead us astray a little bit because we get so caught up in, oh, wow, this is a randomized controlled trial that's, you know, basically is almost as good as it gets when it comes to evidence. But we have to remember to pump the brakes, scrutinize the study itself, consider biological plausibility, compare it to other studies in that area. So the hierarchy of evidence is you have to be really cautious in terms of how you apply it. And, you know, it became very common during COVID for a lot of people to say, you know, follow the science or trust the science. And one of the things that I always like to highlight is that it's actually very hard to follow the science. Depending on how you interpret that phrase, you know, if following the science is just, you know, when you hear about a new study, you accept those findings at face value and start applying it, then you're going to get a lot of contradictory findings. It's going to be really difficult to sort through that and kind of separate the wheat from the chaff. So following the science is a wonderful thing, but sometimes easier said than done. And you have to make sure that you're kind of adhering to these basic principles when you're interpreting science. Lauren, what do you think? How'd I do? Any feedback, comments, disagreement?
I'll just add that, you know, in both examples that you've just given, a single study is never sufficient, regardless of the design, to really move the needle or to change recommendations or behavior. And so it's important to acknowledge that science is slow and it builds on, you know, prior findings, and it's sort of self-correcting, in that once we get enough studies in a particular topic that are of a similar design in a similar population, etc., then that allows us to eventually get to a point where we can start making recommendations. And in a really tightly controlled design, we are able to control certain variables, but on the other hand, we're also kind of sacrificing, in some cases, the real life setting, or what we would call, you know, in nutrition studies, for example, where they lock everyone in a metabolic ward and feed them, and the results of that intervention, but you couldn't replicate that in free living conditions. So while there are tremendous upsides to being really, really controlled about a design, there are also downsides, because if you make recommendations based on the results of that tightly controlled study to individuals who are not in that same environment, you're not necessarily going to be able to replicate the results.
Yeah, definitely. It's really, really important points that you bring up. And it's so hard to, you know, sometimes we see that one study that comes along that confirms our biases, or maybe supports something that we were hoping, you know, might work or might come through. And so it's so difficult to remind ourselves that one study is a great start for scientific literature, but we have to get that replication. We have to start seeing multiple studies kind of coming in, so that we can really get the bigger picture and kind of get a much broader understanding of the topic. Good stuff, Lauren. I think we should go to the live chat and start chatting with the good people who have generously spent their Wednesday evening with us. I'm going to start with a quick one here from Dwight. Is there a good way to leverage a BS in psychology and evolutionary anthropology into doing personal training? I'm passionate about training and feel like I could help others, but I don't want to go back to school. I can't say that I know how it works everywhere, but I can say that in the United States, you do not need a degree from a university to be a personal trainer. You can get certified through reputable organizations. You know, a few that come to mind would be the ACSM, NASM, NSCA, ACE. And by the way, if you're a MASS subscriber, you get free CEUs and continuing education credits, CECs, for all those organizations that just comes with your subscription. So it's important to point that out during our big anniversary sale. So a lot of folks subscribe when the CEUs, we had a huge influx when the latest round of CEUs was due, because a lot of folks realized that we offer a really affordable way to get your continuing education if you're a personal trainer. But anyway, you can get a certification in a lot of places through one of those you know, really high quality organizations, and then go work as a trainer. And you could do that, you know, offering your own services online, joining up with a team of coaches who work online, going to your local gym and working on the gym floor. Usually They're not going to require a degree for that. So if you have passion for it and you can study those materials and pass the exam, you'll be good to go. And you know, and then you can kind of continue honing your craft and being self-educated, you know, following along evidence-based content and continuing to build your craft as you go. Any other comments on that? Lauren, you have a bachelor's in psychology, right?
I do. Yeah, I would just add that those certifications, while they're great and they're typically a requirement in order to get a job in the fitness space, they don't sort of practically teach you the elements of working with a client and being in the gym and adjusting programs on the fly and dealing with sort of the behavioral components of just working with people as well. So certainly the psychology degree can be helpful in that respect. But just the other piece of advice I would give is to find a mentor who you know you really respect, who has built up a successful personal training business, or who is, you know, kind of higher up in a reputable gym that's nearby, and then who's sort of willing to show you the ropes, and that is a great way to do some hands-on training in addition to the more, you know, book type training.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is interesting. Like when you actually get out on the gym floor and start working with folks, you realize there's a lot of stuff that's just really difficult to convey in your typical certification course or even in a degree type of setting. Like there's certain things you just got to, you know, the example I always use is I was working with high school football players, and there was this one workout at the beginning of the year where they wanted to get everybody together as a team. It was a big, big, big football program. And, so they had freshman through senior in the weight room at the same time, and we must have had 135 kids in the gym training at once, and half of them had never touched a weight in their life. Wasn't my idea. I want to make that clear. I don't know if the juice is worth the squeeze when it comes to team building, because it was just chaos in there. And there is not a single certification book that's going to tell you, going to help you actually be prepared to walk into that gym and see these, you know, awkward kids who just started ninth grade mixed in with these seniors who are about to go play Division I football, and you're supposed to somehow coach everything within that spectrum. You know, you're doing Bulgarian split squats, and these ninth graders look like baby giraffes learning how to walk. You know, they're just trying to get the motor pattern down and all that. So there's so much learning to be done as a trainer, and the thing that sucks about it is, in my opinion, it sucks, but it's also really good, is that when you start training, you do your best, you help people, that's great. You look back after doing it for a few years and you're like, I wish I could go back and help those people better that I started with. You know, you learn so much as you go and you're always getting better. And unfortunately, sometimes you look back at how you used to coach and you say, oh man, that was not the way to do it. But yeah, I say, you know, if you're passionate about it, go for it. There's no, in a lot of places, there's no requirement for an undergraduate degree that would kind of gatekeep you from entering that industry. And shout out to a fellow evolutionary anthropology person. That is the department that I'm in currently. It's great if you're into energetics, exercise, or the morphology of lemur talus bones. We got someone in my department who studies that too. So a little bit for everybody. Artzilla has a question. Why is it that whenever I run a specialization phase, the muscles being focused on start to shrink and look flat as the mesocycle progresses and volume increases? I'm not really sure. There are a few possibilities that come to mind for me. I'd say it's possible. I mean, eyes can play tricks on you. That's always a possibility. And as a bodybuilder, I'm not saying, you know, that your eyes are worse than mine. I'm saying my eyes play tricks on me like crazy. So it is possible that your expectancy effects, you're thinking that this muscle is going to blow up because you're focusing on it so much. You know, perhaps there is a bit of a psychological element. It is possible that if you're training it a ton and hitting it with a ton of volume, maybe you're not fully repleting glycogen, depending on the frequency of your training. I'd say that's probably not super likely, to be honest, especially for a muscle group that isn't your legs, basically. going to sneeze real quick. Excuse me. It's allergy season in North Carolina. Everything's yellow, covered in pollen. You're going to sneeze time to time. But anyway, you know, there is the possibility that there's a glycogen thing, but I don't think that's very likely, if I had to be honest. An interesting thing, I actually just saw like the abstract of a paper. I have not read it in full, so I'm not going to co-sign on the conclusions because that would be reckless and irresponsible. But I did see an interesting paper on this topic, but it was actually showing the inverse. They were doing specialization. They were kind of selectively training certain muscles. And what they found was that when folks were training some muscles but neglecting others, and I think these were in untrained people, there was actually atrophy in the muscles that weren't being targeted while the targeted muscles were growing. And the researchers were from the abstract, seemed to be commenting on this idea that there was some kind of equilibrium being reached where initially when someone starts training, these muscles are growing and others that are still as untrained as they used to be for some reason are atrophying on a similar time course. Now, I need to dig into that paper to figure out what's going on there, but certainly a very intriguing abstract, at least enough to get you interested to dive into the full text. But, you know, I would say if I had to guess, I'm more inclined to think that it could be a psychological thing. Or one other thing that's, I guess, possible is if you get a bunch of inflammation in the area because you're just beating the crap out of it and you've got all this kind of, you know, post-exercise inflammation and, you know, that prolonged longer tail of recovery, you could just have a little bit of like fluid retention in the area, just a little bit, not a ton. And that could blur your definition, which oftentimes would look as if you were kind of flat or perhaps even shrinking a little bit just because you don't have that really well-defined muscle belly that you're seeing. So it is possible that localized inflammation could be part of the deal as well. Lauren, are any of those ideas more or less plausible to you? Or do you have others you want to throw in the mix?
Well, I think first I'd say in order to see visible hypertrophy in the mirror, that's either going to take quite a bit of time. When I think about when I've measured hypertrophy with ultrasound after an 8-12 week training study, for example, they might have a small amount of growth, but that's not something that you could necessarily just see in the mirror. So I don't know how long, you know, these phases are, but I'll just sort of throw that out there. And then the other thing I'd say is the concept of sort of looking flat or the look of your physique can really change acutely typically only applies to incredibly lean people in a bodybuilding or physique competition. And if you are that lean, you're probably not in a position where you're gaining much muscle anyway. So that's a sort of different question entirely. And that's just sort of the adjusting things in your peaking phase. I know Dr. Helms has done some great work on that particular topic. But yeah, I don't see anything really physiologically that would explain that observation.
Yeah. And I will say, you know, personally, you know, psychology is a wild thing. I always had the opposite situation. I'd done some specialization phases. I remember when I was hitting the bench heavy 4 days a week for an extended period of time. And when I looked in the mirror, I just saw chest and shoulders. I was like, I'm blowing up. And like realistically, like you said, I couldn't have achieved that much hypertrophy over the time frame I was looking. But, you know, you feel sore there every day, and at least at the beginning, and you kind of, in your mind, you're thinking, man, I'm training this muscle, I'm training it, and your bench press is going up and up and up and up, largely due to neural factors. But yeah, I think your eyes and your brain can really talk you into a variety of different interpretations when it comes to the mirror. All right, we got a question. This one, I'm going to kick to you first, Lauren, because I need to think about an answer. And you, Dr. Lauren, are the protein expert here. Why does all dietary protein count toward daily calories when presumably A very substantial amount of it is used for protein synthesis and therefore not available for oxidation. It's a very fascinating question, and I'm glad you're here, Lauren, because you do all the nerdy stuff with the microscope that looks at some of these outcomes.
So yeah, I mean, you could probably make that argument for any macronutrient, right? That is theoretically being utilized as opposed to, you know, what being stored as fat or ultimately excreted. I mean, I think that if we're talking about daily, there are downsides of trying to track that because we know it's an imperfect system, but it allows us, it provides us with a framework where by which we can track and adjust, and it gives us sort of an input and an output in terms of, okay, if we know that this is our nutritional intake, then we can measure weight loss, or we can measure performance, or we can measure weight gain in comparison to that nutritional intake. I mean, when we talk about even metabolism and we say, oh, there's differences in everybody's non-exercise activity thermogenesis and how that varies so much between people, that's something that's incredibly difficult to measure. And even energy expenditure from exercise is not that easy to measure. You know, in people have various trackers, but they're imperfect as well. So, I think you make a good theoretical point, but practically speaking, if we were to say, well, this portion of this dietary protein is going to presumably be utilized for this or that, and therefore we shouldn't count it as calories, we get into what would be a very, very complicated model of tracking nutrition.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there are some like really specialized applications where it makes sense to actually think about the fate of a macronutrient stored versus oxidized. And of course, like to me, the one that really jumps out is if you're peaking for a bodybuilding show, and you know that you're tremendously glycogen depleted, you know, you can kind of have those extra carbohydrates leading into the show and understand, okay, I've probably got, you know, this many hundred calories worth of potential glycogen storage that I can top off here. Like, that's such a really specialized application of it. I wouldn't really generalize that. When it comes to protein, it's tough. Like, I think one of the reasons that people don't get into this level of nuance is just because you'd have to predict, like, how much protein turnover am I doing today, right? And so you'd have to think like, well, I did burn the roof of my mouth, so that's going to be extra protein turnover to heal that. And I did, you know, my cat scratched my leg because I walked the wrong way, my fault. You know, you have to start thinking about like all these processes in your body that require healing and the addition of new proteins and protein turnover. And I think at a certain point, it just becomes unmanageable because there's so many degrees of freedom and so many different processes to try to estimate. I think a lot of times the more practical way to do it is just to say, hey, I'm taking in this much protein. I know broadly what the thermic effect of protein ought to be, which kind of bakes in, you know, some of these protein synthetic processes in a very broad view. And I think sometimes, you know, having the understanding of those two elements that's probably about as granular as we can get without making so many error-prone estimates that we wipe out the utility of doing the estimation, right? It's, you know, if you make a couple estimates, you got a little bit of error, no big deal. But if you're trying to get really granular and you make 10 different estimates that all have, you know, really wide confidence intervals, large margins of error, at a certain point, it's like you're not really getting that much more granular because you're just being wrong many times. So that would be my expectation. No, go ahead.
We have fairly robust mechanisms for measuring protein synthesis in a research setting. Our ability to measure protein breakdown is really not great. And that's something that researchers will continue to work on it. But the major challenge there is that amino acids can be recycled, right? So it's not just, oh, here's the protein synthesis, here's the uptake of the amino acids. It's not just, okay, now they're degraded, they're gone, see you later. They can be recycled and then potentially resynthesized, right, in a different protein, like the individual amino acids. And so the ability to assess protein breakdown, even at that level, is really complex and really difficult. So the idea that we would try to predict that on an individual level when we're just talking about dietary protein intake and the potential fate of that nutrition, that's, you know, a whole other level.
Yeah, definitely. Lauren, I've got another question for you. I'm not sure if this one is going to be close enough to your wheelhouse here, but we got a question about training for pregnant individuals. So a pregnant individual who's normally interested in strength training, bench, squat, deadlift, all that stuff, planning to focus on hypertrophy during pregnancy to preserve muscle as much as possible. Do you have any general recommendations regarding training and nutrition for this specific situation? Anything to avoid or prefer? Is lower intensity but higher volume a good idea, etc.? What are you thinking, Lauren?
Obviously, I'll start by saying I'm not a physician. I'm not an OBGYN. And so with that caveat, you know, if there are any particular reasons that your doctor might identify that would make exercise, you know, not a great idea during pregnancy, then of course you should listen to them. But typically the guidelines are that if you have been exercising, whether it's running or lifting prior to your pregnancy, there's no reason why you should stop lifting or really make any major adjustments to your training in terms of volume or intensity, particularly early on. Now, as the pregnancy progresses, you might find that there are certain exercises that are really uncomfortable and you're going to need to sort of make some adjustments and modifications for that reason. And then, of course, they're typically doing any sort of twisting or abdominal flexion, extension to large degrees is ill-advised.
Yeah, I echo. I'm not a physician. No medical advice on this, et cetera, et cetera. And I think you raised an important point that every pregnancy is a little bit different. You know, I mean, you might have a variety of potential risk factors and or complications in your pregnancy that might lead to a scenario where exercise is actually contraindicated. But it does seem that for the general population, no particular risk factors at play, your kind of standard low-risk pregnancy, it does seem like the tide is turning a little bit. And the medical advice that I see, not that I'm giving it, seems to be drifting more in a direction that's less conservative than it used to be. You know, it used to be everybody was like, you're pregnant, just don't do anything, just like wait for 9 months and some change and hope for the best. But now, like you said, they started to say, well, I mean, you can keep generally doing what you're doing, you know, just you want to make sure you avoid stuff that, you know, may cause injury, may cause you to like fall. Like, obviously, you don't want to do that. So I have heard of people who go to some lower risk, lower impact types of exercise if they do certain things that increase their risk of falling, which, you know, some types of physical activity can do that. Certainly, a lot of people start to change things when, you know, things become uncomfortable, like bench pressing or squatting can get pretty uncomfortable. I will say that, you know, in our lab here at Duke University, we've got a study going right now with pregnant runners who put in pretty substantial mileage, you know, all throughout their pregnancy, first, second, third trimester. And I'm not at liberty to share any of the results. Particularly, I don't know them when it comes to the details of like birth weights and things like that. But I will say, these folks who are pretty avid runners, I think the majority of them are marathon runners. They keep a pretty high workload throughout the entire pregnancy, and you know, healthy moms, healthy babies seems to be how things are going. So, yeah, I definitely would chat with a medical professional before doing anything if I were pregnant, just to make sure. But it does seem like recommendations are becoming more and more liberal when it comes to exercising in pregnancy. Let's see, we had a couple follow-ups from prior questions that I wanted to address before they become distant memories. So one question here, we're talking about focusing on a muscle, specializing, and the idea that for some reason a muscle would start to look smaller when you're training it more. And there was a follow-up question, could it be a small amount of change in the distribution of fat from working those muscles and having some spot reduction occurring? I find that to be very improbable because, first of all, you'd need to lose a pretty substantial amount of fat to start changing the actual, like, gross mass of a particular muscle group. But more importantly, the best way to gain 5 pounds of muscle is to lose 10 pounds of fat. I can tell you as a natural bodybuilder, and I'm speaking metaphorically there, not literally, when I'm a bodybuilder and I start my cut at 180 and I get to 170, no one says, wow, you look so lean. They say, dude, you got huge, but I got smaller, right? So when you start losing fat, in this case, in the instance of spot reduction, if anything, that would make the muscle look bigger, because what you find is the fat that gets stored around the kind of the edges of the muscle belly, that fat starts to come away, and that kind of three-dimensionality of the muscle group really starts to become more apparent. Maybe you see more vasculature. Maybe you see more cuts within the muscle. Usually when you get leaner, people say you look huge. So I'm very skeptical that spot reduction is likely to be explaining the phenomenon that we've been chatting about. And Jacob mentioned that Jacob has seen a similar study on that, going back to apple cider vinegar, similar study in an obese population, but the effect size was way smaller. I think there are probably 7 or 8 A's in the word way there. And that is correct. You know, like I said, I'm not making any outrageous claims about why the findings from that new study are so incompatible with the prior literature, but the bottom line is they're wildly incompatible with the prior literature, more compatible with like Ozempic and DNP literature, which just lacks biological plausibility. The mechanisms aren't really there. So I think the story's not quite over with that study, but I definitely do not recommend apple cider vinegar as a weight loss remedy. The evidence just hasn't been very strong so far. Moving on to some new questions here. Oh, yeah, this was another one I wanted to get back to. So Steven said, I try to eat in about a 10-hour window. Is Dana for that type of pattern lumped in with more extreme patterns like one meal a day? They seem quite different. It depends on the study. Usually, there have been studies on specifically one meal a day, not including other restricted feeding windows. The most common restricted feeding window that you see in the literature is an 8-hour window. And usually in those studies, people will use at least 6 or 7 hours of that 8-hour window. So you can look at the ones that are done well. Some that come to mind are the ones by Grant Tinsley, who is I consider a friend. I should figure out if he considers me a friend one of these days. But Grant Tinsley does great work on. He's published a lot on intermittent fasting and time restricted feeding. He's done a lot of studies with 8-hour windows, and they report how many meals people ate per day and how long the average feeding window is. When you give someone an 8-hour window in the literature, they usually use all 8 of it, or at least in the 6 to 8 range. So studies will usually separate those things out. When it comes to the new study I was talking about, that observational study using NHANES data, that particular study, they broke things into just like categorized windows. Like I think it was less than 8 was one window, and then like 8 to 10 or 8 to 12. And like they basically broke it up into chunks like that, where each, you know, there's less than 8 and then a bunch of time windows that changed by like 2 to 4 hours each. I forget if the next one was 8 to 10 or 8 to 12, but you get the idea. They kind of ramped it up from there and just categorized eating patterns. So I consider a 10-hour feeding window to really hardly even be a time-restricted feeding window. I mean, a lot of people, I mean, if you think about, you wake up, maybe you're get busy in the morning, maybe you don't eat your first meal until noon, and then you're eating clear through until, 10 p.m.? I mean, you could shift that back a few hours and say you're eating from, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m.? That's like a pretty, that's not a very unusual range of eating, if I'm doing my math right there. So I don't consider anything to be time restricted until you get to 8-hour windows or shorter. And honestly, an 8-hour window is basically just skipping breakfast for all intents and purposes. And when it comes to, you know, which ones seem to be better or worse, I will say, based on the literature, based on a little bit of anecdote mixed in there, if I were purely trying to capitalize on the potential benefit for reducing desire to eat, helping with hunger, satiety, things like that, I'd probably err toward a shorter feeding window, perhaps one meal a day, perhaps a 4 to 6 hour feeding window. But if I were really adamant about supporting hypertrophy to the best of my ability or muscle maintenance to the best of my ability, I'd probably go with an 8-hour feeding window. And 10, I think, would end up being very similar, just to make sure I'm getting at least 3 decent servings of protein throughout the day. Lauren, any reflections on that catch-up that I just did, addressing all those different comments in there?
I think the only thing I'd add would be to your last point when you said if you were trying to do it for kind of appetite restriction benefits, I think going from a, you know, quote unquote normal feeding pattern to a one meal a day or a 6 hour feeding window would be pretty difficult just psychologically. So whereas skipping breakfast can be a much easier adjustment. So and to be able to sustain. So I might ease into it and start at least with that and then see how you go in terms of its benefit in helping you reduce your caloric intake. And then if need be, I'd reduce the feeding window further.
Yeah, you know, I totally agree. And, you know, breakfast skipping is really interesting, not to go on a tangent here, but when I was looking at PhD programs, I actually thought about doing my PhD with someone named David Levitsky at Cornell in their nutrition department. And the thing that really was intriguing to me was the research he had done on breakfast skipping. And, you know, for the longest time, people said, you know, breakfast is the most important meal of the day. Don't skip it. Critical for your health and, you know, maintaining body composition and so on and so forth. And they started to say, okay, well, let's try it. And, you know, you'll also see observational studies saying, yeah, people that skip breakfast, they, you know, are, you know, it's correlated with obesity and all these other things. They said, well, let's try it. Let's do a randomized trial where we actually tell, you know, half of the folks skip breakfast, half of the folks make sure you eat breakfast every morning. And what they found was folks who skip breakfast, they tend to eat larger lunches and slightly larger dinners. But the increase in caloric intake at lunch and dinner combined is not large enough to make up for the breakfast that they missed. So in other words, they were still, you know, reducing their caloric intake, even though lunch and dinner were a little bit bigger, from skipping breakfast. So a lot of folks for the longest time were perpetuating this idea that if you skip breakfast, you are just going to go wild at lunch and eat twice what you would have had at breakfast or something like that, and that it was a recipe for, you know, pretty considerable weight gain. And I wouldn't say that that's impossible. Obviously, there's a lot of variation from person to person, especially when you layer in the psychology of food behavior. But in terms of a population or sample average, it seems like most people who skip breakfast, they actually don't fully compensate for that, and they end up producing a small caloric deficit. when they begin that new meal pattern. So it's always interesting to kind of test some of our assumptions and to put these common myths to the test to see if they actually hold up in rigorous research. Lauren, I think we've got a few questions here. The first one begins with the hashtag trexticular torsion. There's been a lot of trexticular blanks lately. I'm thinking we need to diminish that trend if we can. But the question is, can training increase the risk of trexticular torsion? Maybe different rates and different training modalities. I am going to answer that question seriously. Testicular torsion is not a joke. It's basically when the spermatic cord, I think, twists. And that is a really serious medical emergency. You have to get that addressed immediately because there is a disruption of blood flow. That could be a really, really bad thing. But I don't know of any direct correlation with training. So unfortunately, I can't answer that question, but it is worth exploring if anyone's familiar with any literature on that. The next question is, do you know if there's any relationship between abdominal skin fold thickness and visible six-pack abs? I would say yes. I think we basically, when it comes to having visible six-pack abs, I think there are basically three levers involved, and we can only pull two of them. The other one is just kind of stuck in a particular position. And what I mean by that is we can pull the lever where we say, in order to have visible six-pack abs, I am going to actively lose fat and try to reduce the thickness of my abdominal skin folds. You know, that is one thing that is part of the equation, part of the formula for getting visible six-pack abs, is losing that subcutaneous fat in the abdominal region. The second lever that we can pull is, I am going to build up my core musculature and my abdominis rectus such that it will, you know, have that kind of classic six-pack shape. Ultimately, you want to have a little bit of hypertrophy in that muscle to really impact how much of a defined six-pack that you have. I mean, it really is a matter of, we need to reduce the subcutaneous fat, grow the muscles to the extent that we can. I remember being really discouraged the first time I had a cadaver anatomy course and I saw the rectus abdominis on a cadaver, and I was like, man, that doesn't look like it can grow very much. You know, it's this really long, totally like flat muscle belly. It can grow some though, and that growth is going to have an impact on the visual appearance of your abdomen. Now, the third lever, I said, we can't really pull it. It's just kind of stuck wherever it is. And that's just the genetic lottery that we get, right? We all get certain gifts and certain curses. One of the things we can't really do much about is just the shape of our abdominal musculature. So some people, you know, you've got your linea alba, which runs down the rectus abdominis, and then the... Do you remember what those, are they tendinous intersections, the ones that go horizontally across? I don't know. It's not an anatomy class. I took that like 10 years ago. But basically, you know, you've got these kind of tendinous lines that really dictate the shape of your six-pack. And, you know, exactly how those are shaped, how deep those, you know, those tendinous areas go relative to the muscle belly, it's kind of a luck thing. It, you know, it really is going to be genetically determined. All we can really do is try to hypertrophy the muscle and lose the subcutaneous fat that's covering it. Lauren, anything to add on that one?
Not on that one. Just okay. Sort of scrolling down here. Dwight said we need the Erics to take the gloves off and have a spirited discussion about peaking. I did do a video interview with Eric Helms, which I believe is actually on the YouTube channel, about his peaking experience and his protocols and how those opinions have evolved over time. Trex, I'm not sure if you guys have done any podcasts over on Iron Culture about peaking.
I mean, I'm certain that the topic has been covered, but I don't think that there's the head-to-head battle that people are clamoring for. To give some context, Lauren, I'm a bit of a peaking, I'm not a skeptic, but I am a diminisher. So I am a man who follows the science. I have seen the papers that seem to suggest that peaking can be helpful. I trust the anecdotal experience of peers that I think very highly of. However, personally, whenever I've tried to really peak for bodybuilding shows, I just look worse than if I didn't. So I basically got in the habit of just not trying anymore because my best peak was not trying to peak, and that works for me because it's easy. And I also, one of the things that I would argue with someone about, and Lauren, I mean, you can do a sanity check for me here. Maybe I'm crazy. But when you see people doing these really aggressive peaking strategies, right, where they're going, you know, just like the last, you know, 2 or 3 days leading into the show, we're talking about just taking in literally thousands of extra grams of carbohydrate. My question is, where are they going? Because, I mean, the average person can store 500 grams of glycogen. An extra muscly bodybuilder, maybe that goes up to 600-ish if we're talking natural bodybuilders. And, you know, we're talking about your liver is not going to be totally cleared out when you do a depletion prior to loading. Your muscles aren't going to go to zero, right? I mean, they're going to be diminished in terms of their glycogen content, but they're not going to be wiped out. So, like, I just don't understand the mathematics of where are these thousands of grams of carbohydrate going if you're in such a large surplus from this influx of carbs that you can't attribute it all to oxidation, you know? So I could get in an argument with someone about the mathematics and the theory behind it, and maybe there is just a massive spike in oxidation and energy expenditure from the influx of calories, but I don't know. We'll have to save that for another day and take the gloves off, give the people what they want, Lauren. But I tell you what, there is one other question, there's one other question in the chat. And I think this would be a great one to end on for two reasons. First of all, I want to roll out the red carpet for you and let you cook. And second of all, this is directly related to your dissertation topic, something that's very important to you as a researcher and as a practitioner. And I know you've discussed some of these things previously, but it the question came up again, so it's worth addressing. And I'm just going to let you kind of lay down the ball on your perspectives on this question once and for all. So Chris said, my girlfriend is doing a PT course, and it seems to make the difference between male and female resistance training really large, as if you have to train male and female clients totally differently. Is there any reason to train men and women differently? What's your view on this idea of training your male and female clients you know, very, very differently from one another?
The short answer is no. And I think that this nicely ties back to where we started, where sometimes a paper comes out that might suggest something and people really lean into that and then prematurely make practical recommendations based on evidence that really isn't that compelling. When it comes to muscle and strength adaptations, it's pretty clear that an untrained man and an untrained woman will make similar relative strength gains and muscle gains, meaning that at their starting point, the man will typically be stronger and more muscular than the untrained female counterpart. But the resistance training induced adaptations will be similar when we speak about relative growth or relative strength gains. And as far as rest intervals or training frequency or recoverability, there really isn't sufficient evidence to say all female trainees should be trained that way and all male trainees should be trained this way. Because when we look at the literature, sex aside, there's a huge amount of inter-individual variability in the response to any particular intervention. So we see high and lower responders to various exercise programs, both male and female. So my sort of take home when it comes to sex differences is that we as individuals, regardless of sex, are far more different than all males and all females. So I don't think there's sufficient evidence to train differently based on the sex of your client. And as always, I'd say, you know, a good coach adjusts a program based on the individual's progress, goals, preferences, and you know, behavior change aspects as well. So you know that and all of that is just about training a human being and recognizing your client as a whole person. That's not about the physiological based on your biological sex.
Yeah, I agree. However, I am going to throw a little wrinkle into the mix here. I agree in theory, and I agree on the evidence. And, you know, I've been involved with some research looking at sex-based differences and like set-to-set recovery and things like that. And, you know, there might be some subtle differences looking at group averages that may or may not be practically meaningful, right? So I'm with you on the evidence at the group level doesn't really seem to show much. There's a lot of variability person to person. I'm all with you on that. But from a practical perspective, one of the things that's really interesting to think about if you're someone who coaches others is that due to more sociological factors and psychological factors, in practice, you may find as a trainer that your male clients and your female clients wish to be trained, broadly speaking, in slightly different ways. Not always. There's a lot of, you know, individual variation in terms of goals and what an individual expects a training session to look like. But I do think it's really interesting just from like the sociology perspective of training that there has been so much made of these sex differences in terms of training, and also just, you know, a general gravitation toward different specific goals or ideal physique proportions in different sexes. It's really interesting to see sometimes how even if the science would say train similarly, you still find in some cases that you might say, okay, well, like when a particular client comes to me, they might actually want me to train them differently because they are a particular sex. So what would you say to a client like that who you know, kind of has firmly entrenched beliefs that they need to be trained, for example, differently than a man because they happen to be a woman? Do you roll with it, or do you try to kind of steer them toward a different perspective?
Well, you've posed kind of a complicated question, right? Because if you're saying I'm a woman and I don't want upper trap hypertrophy, then cool, we're not going to do shrugs. I don't see that as a sex-based difference. I see approaching right. that as, you know, helping the client reach his or her goals regardless yeah. of sex. I think there's certainly something to be said for sex-based differences from a sociological perspective or from a behavioral perspective. Certainly anecdotally, I have seen that more women like group fitness, and they like yeah. the sort of group environment. They like the community aspect of group fitness. Fitness isn't optimized for strength and hypertrophy. There often isn't any form of progressive overload. Often they're not using heavy enough loads. And I think way too often in the fitness space, people take the idea of, you know, female specific training to be subpar or you should only be using these 2-pound dumbbells, or you should only be doing quote unquote girl push-ups from your knee because you are female, not because you're not strong enough to actually do a strict push-up. And so I'm concerned more so that a lot of novice female fitness enthusiasts and the coaches who train them are actually not challenging them enough, and therefore they're not instilling the confidence necessary for that individual to really make the progress that they're capable of. And when I've coached women, I've seen that time and time again, where they never thought that they could push that weight. And then they try and they can, and it's incredibly rewarding. And then they're actually able to see the physique changes that they have been working hard for a long time. They just weren't applying the adequate stimulus necessary to get those results.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I have noticed over the years of coaching that, you know, there are so many things that go into being a good coach. There's the nuts and bolts of programming. There's the kind of theoretical base of knowledge. There's the bedside manner and the kind of interpersonal skills, behavior change assistance, things like that. But one of the things that I think some new trainers may not be prepared for is that sometimes you are also swimming upstream a little bit, in the sense that people may come to you with preconceived ideas about what their program should look like, and they may or may not be impacted by kind of cultural norms pertaining to how women typically train or how men typically train. And I've seen myself in some instances actually doing a little bit of pushing uphill to say, well, based on the goals that you've laid out for me, I think you should actually incorporate more of this, even though it may not necessarily fit your preconceived idea of how someone of your gender or sex would typically train. So, for example, I've worked with male clients who are really surprised when I say, like, hey, let's incorporate some direct adductor work or abductor work or some direct glute work. And that's becoming a little bit more common now that the barbell, hip thrust has kind of become more of a thing. But I've talked to a lot of male clients where I introduce or incorporate some of these things, and they say, well, are you sure? Because, like, I thought those were not for people like me, right? And I've seen it on the other side as well, where, you know, I've had female clients, especially female clients who are, female clients and women who compete in physique competitions. And I'll say, like, hey, we probably don't need to do like 90 minutes of pure deltoids on Tuesday, right? Like, there are these certain kind of, like, you'd be amazed how many people, if you don't give them a workout that's going to fill a 2-hour window, just like pure, like, glutes and glutes and glutes and deltoids and deltoids and deltoids. And they're like, well, how am I going to compete? And, you know, sometimes you do have to really earn some trust in kind of breaking through different myths and stigmas and preconceived norms and saying, like, you know, even though the literature is pretty weak in terms of justifying this differentiation of training by sex, I think there are some sociological factors that ingrain some of these notions that as trainers sometimes you're going to be kind of butting up against, and you might have to very skillfully work through and work around them in order to help your client meet their goals. So, that's the thing that I think personally keeps training people fresh, is that it's you get out of the textbooks a little bit, right? Like, Lauren, you and I, we both go into the lab and do science, right? And it's all about the science, the objective facts and all that stuff, all about the data. And it's kind of fun to kind of, you know, you've got your researcher hat and then your mass writer hat, which is pretty much the same as your researcher hat with some slight differences in terms of how it's framed. But I think what's really cool about coaching is that you get to really embrace the kind of the art of doing your craft and interacting with a person and taking these textbook ideas, putting them into practice. I think it's always important for folks who are going to train people to kind of come into it understanding how well-rounded you need to be in order to really serve your clients effectively.
Yeah, and I think to Chris's point in the chat, asking if perhaps these narratives are perpetuated by some PT courses or by some kind of tropes in the fitness industry in general, I think absolutely. And as well as sex-based differences, I'd say this is very true for older individuals where people think, like, oh, you know, you're over 50, let's just sit in a chair and do some band work or go for a light walk or, you know, you're frail, you couldn't possibly move some weight. When in reality, they're a population that really should be doing a sound resistance training program. And there are plenty of examples of people in that demographic who are crushing it in powerlifting and even in physique sport, and certainly for just recreational fitness enthusiasts. So I think it's important to go into a session, especially with a newer client, and really hear them out and try to put those preconceived notions aside, because clients are different, their expectations will be different, their interest in the why behind the what will be different. And it's really your job as a good coach, as a good trainer, to meet them where they are and help them progress from there.
Yeah, absolutely. Really good comments in the chat here. It's a nice little discussion. So Chris followed up and asked if this sociocultural climate is also, you know, you had already addressed this, you know, if these PT courses are contributing. And it looks like we got a sociologist in the chat, Lauren, and they said most sociologists would say yes on that. So I think it's a really interesting chat because the real world is not a controlled experiment. You know, we're out there in the trenches dealing with, not dealing with, but we are engaging with, you know, the science of training, the physiology, the biology, but also expectations that are reinforced by sociological factors and psychological factors. And I think a good coach will be able to kind of see some of these kind of sociologically reinforced things and ultimately filter through them, right? And figure out for a client, let's not worry about the expectations. Let's not worry about the norms. Let's figure out where you want to go and what you want to achieve. I think coaches will either mess up in one of two ways. Number one, they will assume, make assumptions about their client's goals. And that's never a good idea. You should never assume what your client wants to achieve. You should talk to them about it. And so sometimes coaches reinforce some of these norms by assuming goals and then training to that goal, which is not ideal. And then, you know, sometimes folks will, they will kind of, you know, be a little bit too adamant about kind of pushing back on some of these things that they might perceive to be driven by sociology, but it might just be what that client wants, you know? So I think as a coach, it's really important to kind of walk that thin line of figuring out how am I able to support this client, whatever their goal is, without making assumptions about their goals or where their goals come from. I just need to help them get where they're trying to go in the most effective way that we can, keeping them safe, keeping them happy, and keeping them healthy as we go. So, yeah, coaching is a fun game, and I really appreciate that question from the chat. I think that led to a really nice discussion for some folks. Lauren, anything to add before we check out for the night?
Yeah, last thing I'll add is that clients' goals can change over time, so it's also really important to check in frequently and see are they still focused on that goal, or, you know, is their enthusiasm for that waning? I know, especially for people who come in with a physique goal, they sometimes kind of catch the strength bug and they want to transition to that, so they're not as physique focused for a period of time, and that can be really productive. So, yeah, I think it's, as you said, it's about really solid communication. And I know when we both used to do a lot of coaching, any intake with an initial client would always start with a pretty lengthy questionnaire and a meeting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do remember I had folks who would say, like, oh, man, you got to shorten the questionnaire. It's such a pain. But man, I always would receive that feedback and promptly reject it because there were so many times that lengthy intake questionnaire. I mean, first of all, it's a cheat code. It's a shortcut to really getting to know someone very quickly in terms as it pertains to what their fitness history is and what their fitness goals are. But I think a lot of my clients would be surprised at how often we would reference back to it. Because it does kind of help as like a founding document for the relationship between coach and client. It doesn't mean that we're rigidly stuck to any component of it, but man, I would always find myself referencing back to it to get a better understanding of their history, of you know what they're setting out to achieve and things of that nature. Because I would ask not just what's your goal, but why? You know, why is that important to you? And really get to the core of what we're setting out to achieve and what's driving that. All right, Lauren, I think we've gone on about coaching long enough. I just want to reiterate a few things. If you like the show, like, rate, subscribe. It's super helpful. We appreciate it. Of course, probably the best way to support us is to become a subscriber to the Mass Research Review, currently on sale. That's our 7th anniversary sale. All subscriptions 30% off, monthly, yearly, and lifetime subscriptions are for sale. So make sure you take advantage of that before the sale ends on Friday. If you are a subscriber, Mike Zordos has that first ever live piece of Mass content that's going to be on the members' website. That's going to be May 6th at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, talking about positives and negatives of common prescription strategies. So, folks, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for welcoming the newly minted Dr. Colenso Semple back to office hours, and really great work in the chat. We don't compensate folks in the chat for their work, but folks, you are the lifeblood of this show. We appreciate all the great questions and the great conversation that you bring to the table. There was a really good question about how to decide who should be tracking their calories and maybe who shouldn't be in terms of working with someone as a nutrition coach. Great question. I didn't answer it because I wanted to throw that to Helms at some point, because that's like a real area where he spends a lot of time writing and thinking and talking. So we already have some great questions in the hopper for future episodes. So chat, keep it up. We love you. Folks who are listening after the fact, we love you too. But we would love you a little bit more if you happen to join the live chat. So, folks, thank you so much. Take advantage of that sale. I will be back in exactly 1 week. Everybody have a fantastic night and a fantastic week as well.